Welcome to Leadership Unlocked, an interview-style podcast providing insights on how to lead people. Proudly brought to you by Human Interactions Australia. Welcome to Leadership Unlocked. I'm privileged to have Steve Cox, who is the CEO of Destination New South Wales. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Craig. Good to see you.
Mate, great to see you. It's been a long time. Thanks for spending some 30 minutes of your time, and we'll have a bit of a chat about some leadership stuff at that school. But first, as always, we allow you to pitch the business. So let's hear a little bit about Destination New South Wales. I keep saying to you, I think you've got the best job in the world. So
yeah, look,
why is that?
I think I do have the best job in the world. So Destination New South Wales, our sort of, our mission, if you like, is to deliver economic and social benefit for the people in New South Wales by growing the visitor economy. So everything that we do is targeted at growing the visitor economy more broadly. Our vision or our mission is to be the, our vision actually, I always get that mixed up. Our vision is to be the premier visitor economy in the Asia Pacific. And so, you know, the organisation really works as an organisation right across all arms of New South Wales government and then with industry to grow the visitor economy more broadly. And the visitor economy pre-pandemic was about, I think it was about $38 billion worth of turnover. It's about 6 or 7% of GSP. Yeah. So it's a really substantial part of the New South Wales economy. Our strategy takes us out to 2030, $65 billion worth of visitor economy spend. It'll be up to about 7 or so percent of GSP by that stage. Yeah. And the organisation has sort of four business arms, if you think of it like a business, which is the way I operate. The marketing arm, which is about the brand, New South Wales and Sydney, attracting people, getting them to come, getting them to stay, spend more, stay longer and repeat visit. Yeah. And it's got a number of different arms, which we can get into if we have time. We've got the major event arm, which is probably the fun part. Why do I have the best job? Well, I get to sell the best city in the world.
That's right.
And I get to go to all the events. And so we own, operate, manage every aspect of Vivid, which is the largest festival of its type in the Southern Hemisphere, pretty close to the world now. We have almost 2.5 million people go through Vivid. It's just closed off.
Yeah, right.
It was a massive success. So we manage every aspect of that, but then the bulk of our work is investments in events and then helping them make them happen for New South Wales. So everything from bringing out FC Barcelona to play football a few weeks back to the launch of South by Southwest, which we announced a couple of days ago, which is absolutely massive.
That's massive.
So we do all the deals for those, negotiate all that information and bring them to life, major theatres, creative industries, etc. Then we have the policy, product and engagement team, so New South Wales government policy, the visitor economy, the ministerial liaison teams, and product development, so the teams that actually help. So if you think of marketing brings people here and events bring people here, how do we help the industry have the best possible product? So great hotels, great experiences, great things for people to do. So we help train, develop, we do training courses with small operators. About 94% of the industry is small business.
Yeah.
So we help them, could be getting them digital ready, get them online, help them get their product to be able to be sold into international markets, those kind of things.
And customer experience stuff as well?
Yeah, all customer experience stuff. Sometimes we do collaborations. We did one relatively recently with the Restaurant and Catering Association around customer experience.
Yeah, so good.
It's a broad remit. And then stakeholder engagement, so working right across government. So when I first joined, we did the Visitor Economy Strategy 2030, and that set up within government a thing called the Visitor Economy Senior Officers of Government Group, which basically brings the heads of all the different departments related to the visitor economy. So we're one part, but then National Parks has got a big investment, Regional New South Wales has a big investment, Transport has big investments. And how do we bring place management, how do we bring all those parties together to make sure we're all aligned to deliver for the people of New South Wales?
It's a huge undertaking.
Yeah, it's a big undertaking. And then we've got the research and insights arm. So, data, analytics, and helping people make better decisions. This organisation make better decisions, government make better decisions, and then ultimately how do we help industry make better decisions?
Yeah.
So that's kind of what the organisation does. It's very, very enjoyable. It's got its own separate board. So I've got a very strong board of directors. The chair is Christine McLaughlin, who's the chair of Suncorp. And with the University of Wollongong, Cochlear and others, but we've got people like Robin Gilk and Russell Boarding and George Souris. And so there's a range of people, Sally Lone, on that board. And then I report directly through to the Minister Ayres, who looks after enterprise, investment and trade.
So, we're not going to talk pandemic because that's still here, but you're coming out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Vivid was a huge success.
Yeah, really big.
So you're coming out of that and heading in the right direction, I assume. So how are you doing that? How are you just keep working at it and keep finding ways of having different things on, like this South by Southwest.
So I joined just over 2 years ago. I hadn't been in government, I hadn't been in tourism. So I've been a retailer all my career. So I was at David Jones for a long time, managing director of Dimmicks, the book company, for a long period of time, and various retail organisations. So when I first started, the first thing we did was write the visitor economy strategy. So literally what we are doing now, there's no surprises.
Yeah.
Anyone can see that strategy. It's on our corporate website, the DNSW website, and we are delivering against that. And that has three stages. So it's got the stage we're in now, which is recovery, which goes to about 2024, where we think we'll be largely back with 2019's visitor economy spend after the pandemic.
Yeah.
Then there's a momentum phase to 26, and then an acceleration from 26 to 30. That's really based off a couple of things. The ongoing investments into Western Sydney, which is a big growth opportunity, and very much the new airport for Sydney, which is a real game changer. So Sydney has traditionally been relatively limited in its capacity because of Sydney Airport and the curfews. It's operated, it's the number one airport in the country, but it was operating pretty close to capacity. Right now, we're building that back through an aviation attraction fund to get the right airlines to come back in with high-value visitors.
Yeah.
And then making sure we're ready for when the new airport comes, that we can absolutely take the opportunity that comes with.
Curfew's been limiting.
Yeah, very, very much so. Curfew's limiting, the slot allocations are limiting. There's lots of challenges in the Sydney airport space. But that new airport has 24-hour access, so no more curfews.
Yeah.
7 days a week, 24 hours, and that will open up Sydney to a much broader market than we've traditionally had and prevent huge opportunities for not only Sydney but all of New South Wales from the visitation that will come from there.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And so, and especially being located out there, because I think that opens up regional New South Wales too.
Yeah, very, very much so. It opens up, you know, it's exceptionally well located, opens up obviously Western Sydney. So when we think of Sydney, you think of the Eastern Harbour City, and you've got the Central River City, which is Parramatta. Around that area, and then you've got the Western Parkland City, sort of Penrith, out to the Blue Mountains, Wallandilly, etc.
Beautiful.
So, and then obviously, then out into region. So, you know, one of our biggest challenges is to break the mindset that people have, particularly internationally, that a trip to Australia is Sydney, Rock and Reef. And start to open up their minds to Sydney, Broken Hill for the, you know, for the desert experience, the mountains, you know. New South Wales really has everything in one state. We've got the most accessible coastline, some of the very best beaches in the country. You've got national parks, it's all accessible. You've got the Blue Mountains, which is the second largest canyon in the world, World Heritage listed site. You've got the red dirt, the Broken Hill. You've got the, you know, so really the snow in the mountains, it's got pretty much everything. So our strategy is around Sydney Plus. How do we get people to come into Sydney and then get out into the regions, spend time going to Mudgee and Orange and Bathurst and Dubbo and all the different places that New South Wales has to offer?
And it's like, I've been lucky enough, I think pandemic drove it, but other reasons before pandemic, but I've been out to that second largest canyon in the world, and it's just amazing. It's probably one of the most beautiful places in the world.
It is, without a doubt.
And then, you know, places like Dubbo, the zoo is world class.
Yeah, I'm going there 2 weeks.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Are you seeing Steve?
Probably.
You should be. I'm seeing him this week.
So I try to spend at least on average 2 days per month in region.
Yeah, great.
So so I'm going out to Dubbo Zoo and meeting all the people in that area and the operators and so forth in a couple of weeks.
Right? Okay, awesome. We'll chat offline on that one. So leadership is what we're here to talk about. Leadership Unlocked is the podcast. So you did your MBA 2006, 2008,
I'm guessing it'll be on LinkedIn.
Yeah, I saw that.
I would say circa 8 to 10 years ago.
Yeah, right. Like that. And so that you made that decision for a reason. What were you thinking?
Yeah, look, I mean, I had I've been successful in what I'd done up to that point in time, but I didn't have an undergraduate degree. So I started off at university doing electrical engineering.
Yeah, right.
And I wasn't a very good electrical engineer. So I used to sit in the class and look around the room and go, I'm really in the wrong place. And so when I eventually just said, well, I'm just not going to become an electrical engineer. That's why I went into David Jones Management Trainee Program, which is how I ended up going through retail.
Yeah.
So, but ultimately I knew if I had aspirations, which I did, to, you know, take on senior roles, CEO type roles, then you still need that foundation. So I had the opportunity to to go and do my MBA full-time for 12 months. So I left David Jones and I went and did my MBA full-time.
Fantastic.
At MGSM, and it was a great experience. And it was really, you know, a game changer in many ways. So not only from what you learn.
Sure.
But for me, MBAs and that kind of study is really about, you know, the more you know, the more you know you don't know. And it's about being able to ask the right questions, at least have a frame of reference for all the things, business challenges that you may have. So when I was at Dimmicks, I bought a company. So, you know, I literally went back to all my MBA notes. I went, right, what are you know, mergers and acquisitions.
How do we do
what
this?
Do you have to think about when you go through that? Yeah. So it helps you there. But I'd say also that probably the big game changer for my leadership was it was the MBA that really got me starting to think about networking and being connected and making contacts with people.
Sure.
And I would say, out of, you know, lots of different things I've done, but mindfully focusing on making connections with people and building my network of connections since that period of time has been a fundamental game changer to everything that I've done. So being, you know, good personal connections, I think, is a real secret of leadership.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you the number of times that I've, you know, faced a business challenge, wasn't 100% sure exactly which way to go with it, but because I've got a very broad group of connections now, I can pretty much contact just about anybody. I can bring in experts to talk to that assist in that process. So that networking really started from the MBA. So it was the technical learning, it was the models that it gives you to give consideration when you're thinking about business and all the challenges that come with it. But very importantly for me, it's the people connections that started at that time.
So were you doing that through like networking events? Because I know a lot of us don't really like that.
No,
it's all a bit false.
Neither do I. I mean, the only real networking thing I ever did was when I was cycling, we spoke about before.
The ACE.
But, and Sydney Swans for a while, which is where I met my partner. But no, I've never been one for sort of, you know, organised networking. It's, for me, it's just about whenever I meet people, I send them a LinkedIn.
Got ya.
And I make a contact with them. And if I meet someone who's impressive, I send them a note. Not that long ago, when I first started, Michael Miller came to see me. He was the chair of News Corporation.
He came here
to meet me. And in that meeting, he spoke very highly about a guy that he'd done work with. I reached out to that person, and then that person ended up doing our major event strategy with us. So, again, it's just connecting the dots. And, you know, that happens all of the time. And, and for people when they're thinking about their careers, I guess one thing I have probably done successfully is I've gone from retail into government and tourism. So a very major change.
Sure.
And it was, not only was it my connections that helped me secure the job, because, you know, there's one story. So when I went to the interview, I reached out to, you know, being government, the obvious question was, well, what do you know about government? So I reached out, made some connections through a guy that I knew, Jeff Newcomb, who used to be the head of, well, I think he might still be the head of the Independent Schools Association.
Yeah.
I called Jeff, said, mate, I'm going to go for a government role. He connected me with somebody he knew from within government. That guy gave me a lot of information. And then, as it turns out, I went to the interview. I think it was a panel of three or four. And, you know, one of the guys on that panel was Simon McGrath, who's was the CEO of Acor, now at Crown.
He's been one of my guests.
Yeah, so he had a beer with this guy the night before the interview. So, and the other person in my interview was Kim from Treasury, was his boss.
Oh.
So I could sit in there and they'd say, how do you know? So I said, well, I'd use my networks. I spoke to this guy last night and you had a beer with him last night and you're his boss. And so, you know, again, it's just about, you know, being able to work with people.
Yep.
Knowing, you know, being very open that you don't know everything, asking questions, and away you go from there.
And it's interesting that if I saw a thread, obviously there's been massive change here through COVID and then coming out of that, you've talked about that, but there was also the change at Dimmicks because there was, you would have been there when everything was going online.
Oh yeah, very much.
And
so.
that was a massive change. So how did you manage that? I guess manage yourself through that, because that would put a lot of pressure on.
Yeah.
But how did you manage your teams around you with that as well?
Look, I mean, I think that was a huge period of time. So when I first started Dimmicks, Amazon was going, rising incredibly fast. Ebooks were going through the roof. The Red Group, which was the previous biggest book industry group here, which had Borders, collapsed and went into administration. The Minister for Small Business came out and said there'll be no more bookshops within 3 years. And here I was running a chain of sort of 65 franchise bookstores.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was it was a tumultuous time. But, you know, as with everything, I think if you communicate well, set a really positive, you know, agenda and outline, engage with people as you're working through the strategy and what you're going to deliver, but and then have a really clear purpose as to what it is that we do. And, you know, I'm not like a big reader of Simon Sinek or anything, but I do think that, you know, that starts with why thing is a really
it's
important
incredibly
one.
Powerful, that, yeah, that
we've
message.
All, we've all got to have a reason to get up. You know, I had a small gap after my MBA. I went and worked for another retailer who I won't mention today, who I had no alignment with their product category, right? None at all. So I used to stand in front of those doors and go, really, you know, the world wouldn't, no one would notice if this just wasn't here. And so I wasn't aligned from a purpose. And from that point onwards, I've always said I will only ever work in organisations that I've got a strong personal alignment to.
Yeah.
You know, Dimex, I'm a big believer in the importance of literacy, a big believer in the importance of freedom of access to books that aren't just given to you as an algorithm. Huge believer in children's literacy. I ran the charity there for a long period of time.
Started that charity.
Yeah, I didn't start it, but we certainly made a lot of changes.
Yeah, right.
I think, you know, a book and helping children read is one of the greatest gifts you can give anybody in life. And all the most impressive people that I know are broad readers, you know, from everyone from Bill Gates to whatever else. They've, you know, you, if you have a lifelong thirst to continue to learn and challenge yourself,
yeah,
reading's a foundation for that. So that was a strong alignment. And now here, you know, every day I wake up, I help the people in New South Wales. And we make a really big difference to people's lives, both from an economic perspective, from the businesses and the operations, and the visitor economy. I almost never use the word tourism because it narrows the mindset.
Yeah.
You know, the visitor economy, as we've seen through the pandemic, you know, if you don't have visitors, you don't have the restaurants, you don't have the people who supply the cutlery, they don't have the dry cleaners.
The knock-on effects.
The knock-on effects. The taxi,
bigger than anybody
the
that
taxi
actually,
drivers that get you
that's
there.
That's right.
The visitor economy is a really broad thing. So every day I get to wake up, not only sell and promote a city and a state that I'm absolutely passionate about, but ultimately help the people in New South Wales have a better economic outlook.
Mm.
And also that social fabric. You know, when I went to, you know, the Barca game a few weeks ago, we had, what, 82,000 people or 72 or 3,000 people there. The smiles on everyone's faces. And it was the same thing on the opening night of Vivid. I remember leaving my office here, walking down the
straight
rocks.
Down, right?
And the sea of people. Kids, older people, people in wheelchairs, people with strollers, young people, big smiles on their face, back out, experiencing this incredible city that we have.
Yeah, and it is, it's an amazing city.
Yeah,
it's
best city in the world.
But I like the visitor economy concept because I'm down south, I'm down in Cronulla, and it's, you know, it's God's country down there, they tell me.
Yeah.
I'm not allowed to say that yet because we've only been there for 7 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Not so we're not local yet. But, you know, we came in for Vivid. We made a conscious decision to come in. So we are. We're still visiting the city Sydney itself as well.
Right.
And,
exactly,
you know, contributing how we could. Yeah. So, yeah, it's awesome. So tell me about what's your leadership philosophies? Have you got some kind of clear-cut thoughts about what leadership is and what leadership isn't? That's just not right or wrong.
Yeah,
just,
I mean, look, I mean, I guess things that come to mind. I've got a couple of models that always stick in my head.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
So when I was running Dimex, I admired the Sydney Swans as a team.
Yeah.
You know, I thought they delivered above really the caliber of players that they had at the time. And I had lunch with Adam Goods and I spoke to him and I said, you know, tell me what's the culture. And he got me onto Leading Teams. And then I worked with a guy called Gary who worked at Leading Teams, came over at Dimex. And they had a model that was always stuck with me. He said, performance equals commitment times capability times communication.
Ooh.
So, you know, which I thought, and the communication is like the X factor. It's like the times, you know, it's the it's the times three, you know. It's so high performing organizations have committed people. So that why, you know, people who really get why they're there and what they're doing and are bought
into that.
And
how they contribute into that.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
They have capability, which you can build. So, you know, if someone's committed, but they don't have all the capability, then, you know, then I'm very inclined to help them get their capability and develop them and get them up.
Sure.
But for me, one of the X factors in leadership is that communication piece. It's, And there's a phrase that I use all the time, which is real conversations. And now I think people call it having a safe space and things these days. But fundamentally, building an organisation where there's a shared value of what you're trying to achieve, there's a set of shared values, and that you can speak openly about the good things and the challenges without fear of retribution, knowing that we're all here to get the, you know, help the business get to be a better place. And if you have real open conversations, and someone can come to me and say, "Steve, I think you've done that wrong, or you're pushing too hard here," then, you know, that's what I value. I want people to be able to have that conversation and not think, "Oh my God, you can't say that to the CEO," or whatever else, that they can openly talk about it. And as long as it's constructive, you have those real conversations. And that's built up over having interest to people, listening to people, and, you know, and actively seeking out and looking for other people's perspectives.
It's interesting. Simon McGrath said a similar thing, actually. Yeah. He said that same thing about being able to have those. You're welcome to come and have a chat to me and say, "Hey, I've done what we think you're doing this wrong, or you could do this differently."
Exactly right.
But being willing and open and, I guess, vulnerable to be able to take on those conversations and deal with it.
I mean, I think, you know, any organisation that gets in sort of a groupthink mentality, or the CEO's got all the answers, is not going to perform to its highest level. You know, you've got to be able to have open and frank conversations, you know, and that's, you know, that's why football teams do it, because they pull it apart and they analyse it, and, you know, they talk about it and they pick each other up.
Yeah.
You've got to be able to have those conversations, but that only comes when people ultimately have a level of trust that I can have that conversation without fear of any type of retribution.
And that was, the Swans was driven by their coach. What was his name?
I'm trying to think of who was there back there. What's his name? Anyway, come to me later.
Yes.
Yeah. Because
he was...
They did a lot of work on culture and, you know, the Bloods culture, etc.
Yeah.
But again, it's just, you know, people and culture for me... You know, when I first started this organisation, there was... At DNSW, there was no people and culture division, no one in charge of people and culture.
Yeah, right.
You know, it didn't exist. Yeah, so I put in place the first director of people and culture, and now we've got internal communications and we've got teams of people there because, you know, fundamentally, high-performing organisations is all about the people and the teams within them.
It doesn't matter how technical we get.
Yeah.
You've still got to have people driving something. People are just moving around.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You want to attract and retain great people, and people stay because they believe in what they're a part of, and, you know, they're committed to it and they enjoy being there. You know, we can all, particularly now with unemployment where it is, you can all get a job somewhere, but, you know, what keeps people engaged is a sense of, I'm contributing to a greater good. I understand how my role helps and assists us achieve the outcome.
Your thoughts on, like, this great resignation that they keep talking about, do you think that is based on the fact that people don't feel like they're contributing? That people are happy to move around quicker?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, as they always say, I mean, salary is a hygiene factor.
Sure.
You don't want to be out in step with the market, but it's not generally the reason why people will leave unless it's in a massive step change.
Yeah.
It's, you know, are they respected? Are they listened to? You know, do they enjoy being part of what they're part of? I mean, one of the ones that I, you know, also think about leadership that always stuck in my mind, which I think was in Good to Great, was, you know, get somebody off the bus if they're not supposed to be on the bus. You want the right people on the bus, right? And I remember I had a conversation with Mark McGuinness when I was at David Jones many, many years ago, and I've got a lot of time for Mark. I think he's one of the very best retailers in the country. And, you know, he said to me, "Steve," this is a long, long time ago, he said, you know, my only regrets, or not his only regret, but one of his key regrets was not acting fast enough to help people who are not committed and not going to make it in the organisation to leave. You know,
Sorry, I'll interrupt there, but it's an interesting statement, to help people.
Yeah.
Not we're kicking you out because we don't like you and you're not performing. It's like, this is actually in your best interest. Yeah. To go somewhere where you're going to be committed.
If you're not on the bus and you're not, you know, you don't want to be part of that bus and you don't, you know, you're just not fit, and that's happened sometimes, then people are better off for themselves and for the organisation to not be a part of the organisation. And, you know, you have to have that real conversation and say, "Look, Craig, that it doesn't feel like you want to be a part of this," and then help them move, transition to something else. But, and it's, you know, that's tough, but, you know, at the end of the day, you have to have great people in organisations.
Absolutely.
And if people want to be there, then fantastic. But if they don't, then they're better off finding somewhere in their life where they really do want to be.
So you talk about, you know, real conversations where you want real people.
Yeah.
What's some real incidences where you've stuffed up as a leader? You went, oh, that didn't work. Like, is it? Oh, look, is that you're willing to share?
No,
of course.
No. I mean, look, I can talk. I mean, you know, so many. Like, you know, like anyone, you make lots of mistakes all the time. You know, specific. There's no one-off thing. I mean, my, you know, my things that I have to be mindful of in my leadership style is I'm very, very fast-paced.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I've. Very clear where I'm going, so I have to make sure that I stop and have time, let everyone else talk. Yeah, don't go at a, you know, that I set a pace that is manageable for the organisation as well. That I surround myself with people who are different to me also, and be very mindful of your own style. You know, when I remember when I visited David Jones, when I was always, you know, would have been seen as successful. There was a period in my time there where I was, you know, in fact, I was in tears down here in the rocks. Like one day talking to my mum, like it was a long time ago now. Yeah. And I was just like, I was really struggling. And one of the step changes for me in my career was actually I did the one of those 360 circumplexes. Inventory, whatever it is.
Yeah.
LSI.
LSI.
And when I did that, I was massively high in perfectionistic behaviour, off the charts. And you know that all sounds great, but it's actually not because you're constantly, nothing's ever good enough. You're always going, you know, well, that wasn't right, that wasn't right.
Yeah, right.
Fix.
So people can never meet your expectations.
Yeah, you don't spend enough time celebrating success, and you don't actually give yourself any success either because you're always looking at the thing that didn't happen the way you wanted to happen. And when that was, you know, a long, long time ago now, it would have been 20 odd years ago plus, that was a step change in my career because it was the first time I really sort of reflected on my own style and went, okay. And that plays out in lots of things in life. It doesn't just play out in your career.
It
plays out in everything that you do.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mindfully said, okay, you know, celebrate the successes. You know, don't always look for perfection. You know, and I think, you know, the more I work, the more I'm very, very open to test and learn, you know, getting things done and moving forward as opposed to waiting until they're perfect. And certainly in government, that's how I work here. You know, I say to the guys, I don't want it to be, you know, thought through to the nth of everything so there's no risk left, because by the time we go and do that, we'll never get it done. Let's move. And if it works, let's do more of it. And if it doesn't work, let's pull back. So that would have been a step change for me.
So would
as well.
That have affected your communication style as well?
Yeah, very much so.
Hang on, I'm sure I've explained this to you.
Yeah.
Why have you guys not got it?
Yeah, to this day, you know, I mean, I do. I need to make sure I listen, make sure I give everyone in the room an opportunity to speak and talk and, you know, and catch myself out as well.
I love that model, the four levels of, I think it's the four levels of learning, but the third level is that conscious competence.
Yeah, that's
you
right.
can get unconscious competent, it's great, but sometimes you just want to stay consciously competent about, am I listening?
Yeah.
Am I asking the right questions? Am I letting people have a chat?
Yeah.
I think that's really, really
we've
critical.
All got our strengths, but we've also all got our, you know, challenge. And particularly when the pressure's on, and you're in high stress situations, you can have a tendency to fall back to a core set of behaviours, and that can be dangerous as well. So I think, you know, those kind of stages in your career where you actually reflect on yourself, the impact that it has on others. We all cast a shadow. You know, how I operate impacts the entire organisation. So you've got to be mindful of that. Now that doesn't mean I sit around worrying about it every day.
No.
It's just a mindfulness. And you know, adjusting and thinking through, and also empowering people that report to me to say, you know, hey Craig, give me some feedback. You know, what's going well? What are you struggling with? You know, what do I need to do differently to help support you to achieve your outcomes?
Yeah.
And checking in that way, and I probably don't do enough of that either. But you know, those kind of check-ins and ensuring that the people that work with me feel that they can absolutely have those conversations.
So that feels like something you would mentor somebody around. Like, is there other elements of leadership that if you had a young leader coming through that you wanted to take under their wing, and often we hear stories like that happen.
Yeah.
What other stuff would you share with them to say, hey, be aware of this or be?
Yeah. Look, I think leadership wise, you know, I think just communication, you know, connecting with people is probably the key ones. But the other one that comes to mind that I often mentor people with is just simply the five P's. It's the people, product, price, place, promotion.
Yeah.
I can't tell you, particularly in the interview situations, but in business in general, how many people don't think through the full breadth of the challenge in front of them.
Yeah.
And I would encourage everyone to have a couple of models in their mind. You've already heard me talk about performance equals commitment, or capability times commitment times communication.
Yeah.
But the five P's, which is pretty basic,
yes,
has stood me in incredibly good stead in everything that I do. You know, when I've transitioned from retail to here, okay, well, what are you going to do to grow the visitor economy? Well, okay. First thing I'm going to think about is the people. People within this organisation, the we're going through a reorganisation, we've got the structure right for the strategy that we're delivering. What about other stakeholders? How are we engaging with them? How are we bringing people together?
Yeah, right.
You know, have we got the right training? Then product, well, you know, have we got the right product and experiences? What are we marketing, etc.? People, product, price, you know, our relationship with the airlines, our partnership campaigns, all of those kind of things, product, price, place, etc., and then promotion. So having a model in your mind as you think about business challenges, and particularly for people who are going through interview processes, is really, really important. You know, being able to just reflect on, okay, the challenge I have in front of me, most people that I've encountered will have one or two dimensional kind of approaches to things.
Yeah.
The great people think about a broader suite. Everything has multiple touch points generally. It's very rarely that, you know, a significant problem can be solved with just one thing. Mm. It's normally a combination of things working together that gets you to a high-performing outcome.
Yeah.
And so I would say to people in leadership and in development, and I certainly coach lots of people, particularly in interview processes, have some models in your mind.
Yeah, nice.
When you think about the challenges and you've got something to fall back to, I think that's really important. And then also the other one, which I took from the MBA, is just looking at things from different perspectives all the time. So, you know, it's the old thing that a mountain from the top looks fundamentally different from down below.
Oh, yeah.
You know, take the time to reflect on what you're looking at and take yourself out of being CEO and put yourself in the position of this person or that person, or the minister or industry, and then try and have a look at it from their perspectives and go, okay, you'll often see the same thing from a very different angle.
Do you think you do that better because you've practiced it over and over time?
Yeah.
And I'm not, you're not suggesting you're perfect at it.
No,
of course, but I guess it is making that decision, isn't it, to go, no, I'm going to keep persevering at this model, this activity, or this action, so that I get it, better and better each time.
100%. And everything, if you've got some basic sort of models, and that's what it really, for me, that's really what the MBA gave me.
It was
Just the confidence to look at pretty much any business challenge and be able to think about it in a more full and holistic way.
Yeah.
So that you don't get sort of too narrow in your thinking and you take a broader perspective on what you're looking at. And I think if you can look at things fairly broadly, that really does separate, you know, a good performer from a great performer, because you're looking at it and adding some things in from different perspectives. And recognizing, realizing there's just, you know, you're always learning and you're constantly learning. And, you know, we should all actively continue to nurture that. You know, life is a process. You're going to get the most out of it. You just want to keep learning and go along that journey and constantly challenge yourselves and listening out for others and then learning from them and going, you know,
it's,
that worked. That
it's,
work.
For me, one of my values is lifelong learning.
Yeah,
and this is why I do this as well. It's like, well, if people can continue to learn from other people, because I think peer learning is one of the greatest things can do. So
which is one of those things about, you know, working online and versus in the office.
Mm.
I mean, so much of learning, in my view, happens from on the job, watching and listening. I'll give you an example. So the last time we had budget estimates, right? So budget estimates is a pretty grueling process, right? You sit down and you're going to be asked from any angle. Anyway, during budget estimates, we got to a point where they actually said, look, we don't have any more questions for me, as in me in my organisation, Destination New South Wales. You can go if you want to.
Sure.
But I stayed, which most people would go, well, why the hell would you stay in budget? Normally, budget estimates, you're successful, get out of there. But I stayed because I wanted to listen and to learn, and to learn how my peers are answering questions and the different types of questions and the interaction of that room, because you know, it's a skill.
Yeah.
And the more I can learn from others, the good, the bad, and the indifferent, the better ultimately I will be next time I get a budget estimate. Mm-hmm. So again, it's mindfully making a decision like the one I made there, where I said, no, I'll stay. And I stayed and ended up getting another question, which registered. But I continued to learn, and I listened to what other people were doing. And, you know, you just continue to build your toolkit. And you think, and you're constantly thinking, okay, because I'm going to budget estimates in about 4 weeks' time, I'm already thinking about, what am I likely to be asked?
Yeah.
What are my answers going to be? It's not that I'm not sitting down, but in my mind, I'm already working on budget estimates, which is about 4 to 8 weeks away. It's in my head, thinking it through, working the answers.
I think it's extremely powerful. I know even in some of the training sessions that we run for different organisations, you kind of know what the pushback might be with group of people.
Yeah.
And I'm running a session next week, and it's like, okay, I know what the pushback is.
Yeah.
Let me make sure I deal with that and sort that out.
Yeah.
Before we actually get in the room or at the beginning of the room.
That's right.
So people go, oh, okay, he actually understands this.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's move forward now and listen to what we've got to say.
So, a lot can be achieved by a bit of forward thinking. And again, that's at other perspectives and other directions. You know, if I'm going to budget estimates, generally you're being questioned by the opposition. Well, what are they going to be interested in? What are they looking for? How do you respond? So it's all part of that just continuing to build. And every part of your career is important. And every stage of your career is important, and they all add up to ultimately the person you are.
So what do you need to do now in your mind? Because your mind, you're obviously at a great level, you're working with a great organisation, and I did some work with Dimix as well, and that was a great organisation. Yeah. What's next for you as far as your leadership, I guess, capability?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think right now, it is continue to develop, but give back where I can. Yeah. So, I'm very happy to do a podcast like this.
I've
helped many people. In fact, I had someone come into my office the other day who's a senior person. She's looking to make a transition. We spoke. I gave what I could help to help her. And then I connected her with 5 people in my network who, I thought, out of all the people that I know, these 5 people would be good people for you to go and have a conversation with. And then I made that connection and did the introductions. She's now connected with 5 really high-performing individuals who may well be able to help her get to the next stage of her career. Next week, I'm going to a university training session, and I'm just doing a speech on and working with the students there on what we do, how we do it, etc. So I think, for me, it's keep learning and keep challenging myself. And I've got an amazing role, which is always challenging. It's incredibly diverse. But, the more, the older you get, the more if I can give back, and the more that I can give back, the better.
It fills that need of contribution
and assist other people to help them achieve their outcomes.
So on a personal level, so people know you're not just this amazing, leader running Destination New South Wales with the best job in the world. What do we do outside of, what's personal for you? What do you do? Is it surfing? Is it riding? Is it running? Is it what's your insight?
Travel. And I do love travel. I mean, that's I think it's one of the beauties of this industry is, unlike the book industry, which could have got disrupted with e-books, I mean, there's a core value in travelling, and I think, experiencing, going to places, connecting with people, I think all types of travel is incredibly beneficial to the individual, no matter where you might be going, whether it's local or interstate or internationally. So I love travel, and obviously that's a good alignment with what I do. I go to Barry's boot camp on a regular basis to keep fit. I used to cycle a lot, I've sort of parked the bike for a while. I spend time with my family and my partner, when I can, there's nothing I enjoy more than eventually finding some time to sit down and read, which is generally non-fiction. Various things. How does the brain work? Whether there's free will, things like that.
What book are you reading right now?
You can ask me. I'm just having a mental blank on what it is, but it's basically one on the sort of the history and philosophy of the mind.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. I'm fascinated with free will and whether or not it exists
or not.
And I love, there's some really great podcasts out there. I mean, I think we're blessed. I mean, I think we are. You think back to when I was a kid and we used to have to go to the Funk and Wagnalls to find information. Now there is so much information.
Yeah.
It's about, what are you going to invest your time in listening to?
Yeah.
Podcasts are a great way to do
that. Wonderful, right? And not end up down rabbit holes in
Google. Exactly right. But, You know, I think I like people who challenge my thinking. Yeah. I like people who bring me new ideas. And, you know, I say that to the people that I work with, you know, agencies we work with. I say, guys, you know, I want you to come here and tell me something. You know, challenge my thinking. Yeah. Find, you know, take us to a next level, because that's where you get those step changes. You know, step changes, it can be, you know, it's a lot of hard work, and then all of a sudden you can make that leap because one great new idea comes in. So, you know, I guess I invest time. Friends and community are really, really important. I think when I was a kid, my dad was, my family's in the air, my dad was in the Air Force.
Yeah, right.
So my dad's the last living member of the original Rule Vets aerobatics team.
Oh, wow.
So he was an Air Vice Marshal in charge of all defence personnel. But we moved a lot. And so as a kid, I did like 12 schools in 12 years. So I didn't have that long-term connection to friendship networks.
Yeah.
And I think now at this stage of my life, I'm much more mindful about the importance of community and the importance of, you know, personal friendships as well as, you know, your work achievements.
Networks,
and I think
you know,
measuring yourself is as much about your friendship connections in your community and how you are with others than just what you achieve in your work and work life. So, you know, family is really important, but that broader community of people that you're with and you know, and nurturing that and looking after that, I think is important as well.
Fantastic, mate. What a great spot to finish on. Steve Cox, thank you so much for giving me your time. It's been fun as always. And
great to see you.
I look forward to posting this pretty soon.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Great talk. Thanks.